pieces of rope instead of just one or two. It makes each carbon atom very secure. There are other kinds of atoms that make four chemical bonds, but none of them form substances as hard as a diamond. This is because carbon is the smallest atom that can join to four of its neighbors. Its tiny size lets the carbon atoms snuggle more closely together than other atoms can, creating a firmer, harder material. It takes very high temperatures and pressures to pack carbon atoms tight enough to make a diamond. Without these, carbon atoms form materials like coal or graphite. Once they've been pressed into a diamond, however, those carbon atoms are there to stay. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Kenneth Calton in chemistry. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41. Coming up today at 3 on The World from PRI, a glitzy soap opera from Istanbul was a flop on Turkish TV, but it drew 85 million viewers in places such as Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Many of them are now flocking to Turkey to see a different kind of Muslim culture. Turkey's growing appeal across the Arab world. That story in the day's news on The World this afternoon at 3. Let's take a look now at sports news. The Phillies and Rockies are first up on the postseason baseball schedule for a second straight day. That game is now in the bottom of the third. Colorado leads Philadelphia 1-0. Philadelphia topped Colorado 5-1 yesterday to grab a 1-0 lead in the best-of-five National League Division Series. Adam Wainwright and the St. Louis Cardinals try to even the National League Division Series with the Los Angeles Dodgers today. This will be Wainwright's first postseason appearance since he closed out the World Series clincher against Detroit in 2006. It's a rematch of last season's NHL Western Conference Finals tonight in Detroit as the Chicago Blackhawks take on the Red Wings. They knock the Blackhawks out of the playoffs in five games. After winning both games on a European trip, the St. Louis Blues play the Atlanta Thrashers in their home opener tonight. The Blues open the season with two wins over Detroit. Troy Murphy, Brandon Rush, and Roy Hibbert scored 20 points each today to lead the Indiana Pacers to a 126-104 victory over the Denver Nuggets in the first NBA preseason game ever played in Taiwan. And Illinois guard Jeff Jordan is talking to coaches about coming back. Michael Jordan's oldest son left the team in June after playing for two seasons. He said then he wanted to focus on school. Illinois spokesman Derek Burson says Jeff Jordan recently met with assistant coaches about a possible return. Jordan hasn't yet met with head coach Bruce Weber. That's sports.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
When the Senate picks up debate on the climate change bill, it will be in part deciding the future of coal as an energy source in the United States. About half the nation's electricity currently comes from coal, and a lot of coal comes from Appalachia. A new documentary film sets out to show how mining for coal affects the people who live in coal country. Julie Grant spoke with the film's producers.
Mary Lynn Evans and Phyllis Geller set out to make the movie Coal Country because they wanted to show how different people are affected by coal mining. They found lots of activists and regular citizens who would talk with them. Plenty of people were willing to show the thick black water in their toilet tanks. They wanted to show the black soot covering their cars. And they wanted to talk about the health problems they live with. And they all blame the coal industry. Evans also wrote to coal supporters to get their side of the story on camera. The answer?
No. That was the response. I mean, I sent out requests to the coal industry and to coal companies and to suppliers of the coal industry.
Evans' brother is a coal miner. He supports mountaintop removal. As we see in the movie, that's when coal companies blow off the entire top of a mountain to get to the coal. Many people consider it the most polluting and environmentally devastating type of mining. But Evans says not even her own brother would do an interview about it.
And when I said, you know, why won't you talk on camera? I mean, you feel so passionately that, you know, coal is wonderful and mountaintop removal is actually good for the environment as well as the economy. And his response to me always was, oh, I would never speak on camera without getting permission from my, you know, from the company I work for.
The filmmakers heard that a lot, and no coal miners ever did get permission to talk on camera. In the movie, we do hear from Don Blankenship, head of Massey Energy. He spoke at a public hearing about the need to ease environmental restrictions on coal mining.
We had nearly 800 employees up to Friday. We had to lay 8 off. I think that might be just the tip of the iceberg if we don't get some of our rules changed on how we mine in the state.
Anti-coal activists at the public hearing explain how the coal companies use that kind of intimidation to control miners.
That's the only way they can ever get support for how they treat their workers and how they treat this land. This would never happen in a place that wasn't poor. Never.
In the movie, some coal miners stand up at that public meeting to defend the companies they work for. One explains the coal industry has provided him a good salary.
For the last 14 years, the coal industry has supported myself, my wife, and my 3 children.
The last one of you so-called environmentalists, when you leave the state of West Virginia, when the rest of us move to North Carolina, turn out the lights. Oh, wait a minute, there won't be no lights. No coal, no lights.
The filmmakers want more Americans to understand that when we flick on the light switch, it's not a meaningless act. It takes electricity, and that takes coal. And as anti-coal activist Judy Bond says in the movie, coal is tearing apart West Virginia.
It is a civil war. It's families against families. It's you know, brother against brother.
Or in the case of filmmaker Mary Lynn Evans, brother against sister. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
In Russia for more than 4 decades, an automaker has dominated a Russian city. Its plant churns out the country's iconic Lada sedan. The car is a car for the masses, cheap and basic. But today, sales are plummeting and the company plans to cut 25,000 jobs. It's the first time a Russian city will face such massive layoffs. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
With one of every 7 residents in Tolyatti working at Avtovaz, just about every family depends on the factory. As sales have plummeted, production has been cut in half, along with a work week and salaries. 38-year-old metal worker Vladimir Potomishchev now earns only $250 a month, not enough, he says, to feed and clothe his family. He blames Prime Minister Putin for focusing on oil and gas at the expense of Russian manufacturing.
I once believed in Putin and Medvedev, but no longer. We sit on oil and gas, and they think that's just fine.
The overall global economic crisis laid bare long-standing problems at the plant, which produces outdated models which cannot compete with foreign imports. In one of Tolyatti's many car showrooms, salesman Alexander Koblov says the plant needs to improve quality.
All too often, the doors don't close correctly. And the plastic is poor. And, of course, we need new designs.
Sergei Tselikov, a leading industry analyst, says Putin approved new management at Avtovaz 4 years ago. But Tselikov says it's failed to come up with a long-term strategy to save either the plant or the city.
Management is not from the automobile industry, and there continues to be a huge turnover at the top. They're lurching month to month with no real plans for the future.
This summer, the government, which indirectly owns 25% of Avtovaz, provided $1 billion in emergency support to avoid what Putin described as the General Motors scenario. But it wasn't enough to avert the massive layoffs. More money, a lot more money, is still needed. On Friday, Putin demanded that Renault and its partner Nissan, the 2 largest foreign shareholders, help modernize the plant, or Putin threatened to review their status. Once the pride of the Soviet Union, Tolyatti is now shabby. Pyotr Zolotaryov, head of the local independent trade union, anticipates the situation will only get worse.
The local government doesn't have taxes to repair roads or fix the lights. There are problems with the water supply. The infrastructure is wearing out. We see much more crime, more drugs than ever before. The best and the brightest, who could save the city, are fleeing.
Analyst Tselikov estimates that for every job lost at the plant, another will be lost in town, bringing the total new unemployed to as many as 70,000. Officials hope public service jobs like street cleaning can cover some of these numbers, but most people don't see how the city can cope with this unprecedented crisis. Victoria Melnikov works at a clothing store.
Everyone is already feeling the effects of the pay cuts. And now everyone is wondering if they will have a job. My parents work at Avtovaz. If they lose their jobs, what will they live on? Nobody knows what's going on.
Anatoly Ivanov, a member of the city council, says the situation is potentially explosive.
Will there be strikes? Will there be violence? Will workers close the main highways like they did in Pikolyova last summer? It's very possible it could reach that point, and the security services are poised to stop this.
Management has yet to announce which workers will be let go, only saying the first to be cut will be those who are at or near pension age, 55 for women, 60 for men. Nikolai Chubenko moved here to build the plant in 1968. Now 60, he has no idea how he and his family will survive if he's among those cut.
Some Russian economists say the crisis is over, but we see it's just beginning. Everyone is just waiting.
Waiting and hoping they're not on the list and wondering what happens next. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Tolyatti.
Singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash joined NPR's Steve Inskeep recently to talk about her new album.
Roseanne Cash has a new album in which she sings one of the more famous lines in country music.
Lights in the harbor don't shine for me.
Many artists have recorded this song over half a century, and we're going to listen this morning to the many ways it's changed. The song is called Sea of Heartbreak. Roseanne Cash sings it with Bruce Springsteen.
Sea of Heartbreak. Lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress. So
the song is on Roseanne Cash's album, The List. The album title refers to a list of timeless songs made years ago by her father, Johnny Cash.
I was out on the road with him, and he mentioned a song and while we were riding on the tour bus one day, and I said, I don't know that one. And he mentioned another, and I said, I don't know that one either, Dad. And he got very alarmed. I was so steeped in the Beatles and Buffalo Springfield, and he thought I was missing something essential about my own musical genealogy. So he spent the rest of the day making this list.
Sea of Heartbreak made the list. Co-authored by the same songwriter who wrote hits like Walk On By, its first recording came in 1961. It was by the country star Don Gibson.
I think he was a bit tortured, and he had somewhat of a difficult life, and all of his experience and his longing and his own heartbreak is really apparent in his vocal. And the way he kind of hums into the first line, you know, and throughout the song is so beautiful.
The lights in the harbor don't shine for me.
It uses a metaphor, and it keeps that metaphor all the way through. And many songs that have tried to do that, you know, kind of fall over into kitsch trying to do that.
They get ridiculous after
They get ridiculous, right. It becomes a parody. This song starts with that metaphor of sailing on the sea of heartbreak, and it uses it to absolute perfect effect. You know, the lights in the harbor don't shine for me. Oh, God, it just breaks your heart.
This sea of heartbreak, lost love alone.
But, you know, there are some other really interesting versions, Steve. I don't know if you've heard the Searchers version.
I have heard the Searchers version.
It's beautiful.
Sea of heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memory.
You like that with the harmonies kind of trailing behind the singer almost?
I do. It's interesting. Everybody wants to reinterpret that low male voice on the Gibson record in some way.
Jimmy Buffett sings it, and it sounds to me like a Caribbean church hymn.
Yeah, it even has steel drum on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perhaps a mistake.
Well, I don't know. I like it. But he really slows it down.
He really slows it down, but I think it's slowed down a bit much. They have to kind of drag over those phrases.
Oh, what I give to sail back to shore. Back to your arms once more.
Now, when I think about the way that your father, Johnny Cash, recorded this same song, Sea of Heartbreak, I almost want to use the word resolute. He sounds resolute with the tempo that he chooses and the way that he sings it.
I always thought his version was a little aggressive. You know, he was recording with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, mm-hmm. and I think maybe he was a bit too energized by them.
The sea of heartbreak, lost love and loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine, how I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on this sea of tears, sea of heartbreak.
You mentioned that you think your father might have been affected by collaborating with another musician. And, of course, mm-hmm. you collaborate here not only with your husband, John Leventhal, who produces and plays guitar, mm-hmm. but you also bring in Bruce Springsteen to sing some harmonies.
Yeah, I couldn't find anybody good, so I got Bruce. You know, I wanted to do this song as a duet, and it was John's idea to ask Bruce, and I thought, yeah, maybe there's a 50-50 chance Bruce will do it. He doesn't do that many duets. But he said yes right away. And, of course, he knew the song. He's very steeped in country and roots music. And when John put the vocals together, finally, he said, my God, it's so romantic. And this is my own husband talking.
Sea of heartbreak.
Bruce, who knew he was such a great country crooner?
Oh, what I'd give to sail back to shore, back to your arms once more.
We made this song even more introspective than I think the Don Gibson version.
Did you experiment with different tempos, instrumentations, ways to play this, given that there are so many different versions of it?
Yes. John wrote the arrangement for this, and he actually wrote four different arrangements before we got to this one. And it was just torturing him. And then he went to the studio alone one night to work on it. It was really keeping him up. And he came home, and he said, I've got it. And his face was just lit up.
Come to my rescue.
What do you think your father might have thought of this version if he'd heard it?
I think my dad would have been so proud. You know, I spent my life as a songwriter, sometimes pushing away this music.